Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Welcome to GabFest Reads. I'm David Plotz, one of the hosts of Slate's political GabFest. In 1977, when I was a first grader in D.C. public schools, Lafayette Elementary, the city was gripped for several days by an extraordinary event. And even today, 46 years later, the feeling of those days remains powerfully in my memory. So powerfully, I literally think about it every time I drive up 16th Street. And now Shahan Mufti has written an absolutely brilliant and mesmerizing and page-turning account of an event that you probably never heard of, but which was massively important in shaping America's relationship to Islam and to terrorism. Mufti's book, American Caliph, chronicles the 1977 siege of Washington, D.C., when a small Muslim group based in D.C., based out of a house on 16th Street, took more than 150 hostages in three buildings, killed a young Howard University journalist, nearly killed Marion Barry, then a city council member, soon to be mayor, and brought the city to a standstill. The Hanafi Muslim takeover of the B'nai B'rith, the National Islamic Center, and the district building was, and I think remains, the largest hostage taking ever on American soil. Shahan Mufti, you are chair of the Department of Journalism at the University of Richmond. Congratulations on writing a remarkable and magnificent book, and welcome to GabFest Reads.
Thank you so much, David. It's great to be with you.
So there are so many threads in this book. It is a history of Islam in America. It's a history of the Nation of Islam. It's a TikTok about a terrifying hostage situation. It's a story about the most ambitious movie ever made about Islam. It's also, incidentally, a story about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. But it is most of all the story of Hamas Abdul-Khalas, who is the American caliph of the title. So, Shahan, start by telling us a little bit about Hamas Khalas and who he was and the group that he led.
So, right, Hamas Abdul Khalas is the Muslim mystic of in the title of the book. And he is, I'd say, the one who wants to be American caliph, the leader of Muslims in America, among several other characters in the book. But Hamas Khalas is born in Gary, Indiana. He's the grandchild of slaves. His parents had moved north during the Great Migration from the South and settled in Gary, Indiana, where he was born in 1922. I describe some of his childhood in the book, but my readers really encounter him for the first time when he's serving in the U.S. Army. He's a Buffalo soldier, and he's about to get deployed to Europe during the Second World War. But the reader sees him actually at a hospital getting a psychiatric evaluation. And that's really where the story begins in some ways. And this whole question of his mental condition hovers through the book over him. He's let go of from the army and collects from the GI Bill for the good part of his life, remainder of his life. But he goes on to do many other things. He ends up in Harlem, where he becomes a really successful jazz musician. So he arrives there just as bebop is developing and plays with some really successful jazz musicians of the time, but also is, you know, a successful jazz musician in his own right, tours through Europe with a band, and then returns to New York. And it's in New York that he is New York is the place, Harlem really is the place where he also encounters Islam for the first time. His understanding, his belief in Islam evolves over his life. But that's the first time he encounters Islam in the shape of the Nation of Islam, which was a very specific, particular group of African-American Black nationalists. They were headquartered in Chicago, but had a strong presence in Harlem. And that's the place where he also meets a famous member of the Nation of Islam named Malcolm X, who are both at Temple No. 7 in Harlem.
I was really struck as you, the parts about Harlem and the parts about him as a musician is, how is it that Islam takes hold among Black musicians so strongly? Why does that happen?
Yeah, there were several versions of Islam just ran through Harlem. Some of them were, and a lot of them are coming from the, you know, Marcus Garvey's movement that had elements of Islam to it. There was the Moorish Science Temple, which was another Muslim, African-American Muslim movement that had organically developed in the American Midwest as well. And then there was the Nation of Islam, and then there was just more traditional Sunni Islam that was coming through immigrants from Africa, the Middle East, South Asia. So a lot of this was in Harlem at that time. But yeah, the jazz scene was particularly specifically gripped with, there was this fascination with Islam at the time. And a lot of big names were, you know, subscribing to Islam, experimenting with it, dabbling in it. I mean, essentially, it was a religion of empowerment for a lot of African Americans generally, because Islam, the way it was being preached and understood in Harlem and in Black communities all over the country, was a religion that was the original African religion. That was the religion that the slaves had before they got on the slave ships. So in a way, it was a reclaiming of the past. It was a reclaiming of a lost past. And also, you know, a lot of people are drawn to it because of Islam's emphasis on equality among races, between races. So, you know, and that was helped by the lack of imagery in Islam as well. So there was a white Jesus that Black, you know, African Americans were used to seeing, who was a very white Jesus. But in Islam, there were no images of the Islamic prophet. There was no image of Allah. So in a lot of African-American imagination at the time, this was a religion that had no color, and it could have been Black as much as it could be anything, you know, anything. And so it really takes stronghold in the Nation of Islam, though, was the first major organized Islamic group that really grew among African-Americans in the United States.
The events of your book are unfold kind of around a fundamental conflict between the Nation of Islam and the group that Khalis ends up leading, the Hanafi Muslims. So what is the nature of that conflict? How does it explode into these series of terrible events in the 1970s?
So Hamas Abdul Khalis, he joins the Nation of Islam in the 1950s and shoots up the ranks. He is a really remarkable personality. Not only is he a great jazz musician, he's also completed his undergraduate degree, first at Purdue, completed it at City College, New York. And he's one of the very few people in the Nation of Islam, at least, who is college educated. The Nation of Islam was already drawing from a lot of the incarcerated, so in prisons. The Nation of Islam was already spreading pretty quickly. So there were a lot of, you know, there was, to be a college educated Black man in the Nation of Islam was pretty unusual. Khalis really shot through the ranks. So, and I explain in the book that it's overlooked, but Khalis was one of the top few people in that really important Black nationalist civil rights organization in the 1950s. There's a photograph in the photo insert of him, Malcolm X, and Elijah Muhammad, the leader of the Nation of Islam. He was Elijah Muhammad's personal secretary at a time, and the national secretary for the organization. So he was deeply involved with Elijah Muhammad's personal life. He was scheduling his travel. He was writing, some people said he was writing op-eds on behalf of Elijah Muhammad. He does leave. He's ejected from the organization or is kind of excommunicated from it after a few years working directly under Elijah Muhammad in Chicago at the headquarters. He started butting heads with a lot of very important people in Elijah Muhammad's inner circle. And I describe those events in the book too, his departure from the organization. Soon after he leaves, though, is where he encounters Islam for the second time. And that is the more traditional Sunni version of Islam, as practiced by many people in South Asia and the Middle East and Africa. That message is coming to him from an immigrant Muslim from the Bengal region of India. And he introduces Khalis to the Sunni Islam, but also fills his head with a lot of ideas about what the Nation of Islam actually is. And in that telling, it was a conspiracy hatched by Zionists to derail the growth of Islam in America. So basically, Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam are a Zionist plot, and they are sent to destroy Islam in this country and not let it take off. Khalis takes that to heart. And because of his bitter experience in the Nation of Islam, it becomes not only a religious battle for him after that, it's also a personal battle to stop the growth of the Nation of Islam, which is growing very quickly, but also it's the religious mission of spreading the true Islam, of Sunni Islam, which he calls, and his master calls, Hanafi Islam, and spread that throughout America. That is the struggle that, yeah, as you said, that is the tension that is driving a lot of the events up to the hostage taking in 1977 in Washington, D.C. End of 1972, Hamas Khalis started a letter writing campaign against the Nation of Islam and started to reveal a lot of what had been told to him by his own teacher, his Sunni Muslim teacher, but also drawing on his own inside knowledge of the Nation of Islam. And he cast Elijah Muhammad, like I said, as a Zionist agent, as somebody who was there to derail Islam, and a liar, and all kinds of things. That Nation of Islam reacted to that, the letter writing campaign, very strongly by sending a group of assassins to Washington, D.C., where the Hanafis were headquartered by that time. And assassins' mission was basically to wipe out the Hanafi movement by assassinating Hamas Abdul Khalis, but also his followers. That turned into a bloody, horrific massacre at the Hanafi Center in 16th Street in Washington, D.C. They did not manage to kill Khalis, but they did kill seven other people, including four of Hamas Khalis's children. This one of the youngest one was just 9 days old at that time, and he was drowned. That baby was drowned, and a few other children were drowned, and a few others, including his wife and daughter and two grown sons, were also shot. That is where this whole thing becomes very personal for Khalis as well. After the Nation, he blames the Nation of Islam publicly for it, soon after in a press conference, and from there the conflict just continues.
And so what does he end up doing in March of 1977?
Before I get to 77, between 73 and 77, there are a series of trials where Khalis and the Hanafis are hoping to get some kind of closure and justice. The American justice system is moving too slow, though, for them. And after 4 years of trials and retrials and mistrials, Khalis does decide in 1977 that he simply had enough, and hatches this plan to attack these three locations in Washington, D.C., like you said, the B'nai B'rith on Rhode Island Avenue, the Islamic Center, which is just a couple miles away on Massachusetts Avenue, and then the district building, which houses the city council, Washington's city council. What triggers this for him is actually something entirely unrelated, which is a Hollywood film about the Islamic prophet that's just come out that day.
This kind of interplay of things, these interplay of forces, is fascinating. But what does he do? They take over these buildings and demands what?
A few hours on the morning of March 9th, Khalis and 11 of his followers, they, in three different groups, take over these three buildings. Seven men enter the B'nai B'rith, take over the entire building, take over more than 100 hostages, most of them employees of B'nai B'rith, most of them Jewish. Three others go to the Islamic Center, take hostages there. Most of them are actually Muslim, because it's the Islamic Center, and also some of them who had diplomatic or quasi-diplomatic status. And at the district building, two other Hanafis take over the fifth floor of the building where the city council is. That's the bloodiest location. That's the most violent takeover of all. That's where there's a gunfight, shots are fired by police and the Hanafis. And within a few, the first half hour of that standoff, there are three bodies lying on the floor of the fifth floor of the city district council, of the district building. One of them, as you said in your intro, was a young Howard University radio journalist. Another one was a security guard. And the third one was Marion Barry, city councilman, who would go on to become mayor. That is the takeover. It happens over a few hours, like I said. And by the time that things are happening in the district building, which is the third location, it's become very obvious to DC police and also the FBI, which quickly becomes involved, that this is a coordinated attack on Washington. These are not three independent attacks. This is all one. And that is where it's pandemonium in downtown Washington. Places are getting evacuated. The National Theater is evacuating thousands of people. Courts are getting emptied out. National monuments are closed. So Washington, D.C. by 3 p.m. that day on March 9th is under siege.
And what does Khalis demand?
So, yes, Khalis's first demand is about the movie. There's a movie about the life of the Prophet Muhammad that's premiering in New York City and Los Angeles that day. Khalis wants that movie to not play and be stopped. And not only that, he also demands that the reels be removed from the United States. For several hours, that's actually his only demand. I described how Washington and New York police are struggling to get that movie stopped, which actually does begin at 2 p.m. and starts to play. Once that demand is somewhat met, because the premiere is actually canceled mid-reel, it's stopped, Khalis's other demands emerge, which include delivering to him at B'nai B'rith all the accused murderers, the people who were involved at the massacre at the Hanafi Center 4 years earlier. On top of that, he also demands Wallace Muhammad, who is Elijah Muhammad's son, the Nation of Islam. He has taken over the organization in the meantime. He wants him delivered, but also his star disciple, the heavyweight champion Muhammad Ali, to be delivered to him. So he's asking for bodies to be delivered, well, people to be delivered to him, and he promises to execute justice, whatever that, well, most people assume that meant that he would kill these people. And then there's a third demand, which is he's asking for $750 in cash. It's a cryptic demand, but that really is pointing to the 4 years preceding between the massacre and this hostage taking and the experience that Khalis and the Hanafis had in the court system and the judicial system of Washington, D.C. and in America, well, federal judicial system too. And that is his frustrations. And $750 is really, in his mind, the price of the injustice that he and the Hanafis suffered in the courts.
This episode of the Gabfest is sponsored by Aura Frames. Are you ready to win Mother's Day? Cement your reputation as the best gift giver in your family. Give the moms in your life an Aura digital picture frame preloaded with decades of family photos. That mom will love looking back on childhood memories, seeing what you're up to today, checking out grandkids, checking out cousins. And even better, with unlimited storage and an easy-to-use app, you can keep on updating your mom's frame with new photos so that it's the gift that keeps on giving. This is how I live in my family. I gave my mother an Aura frame It was either for Mother's Day or for her birthday. She absolutely adores it. She's constantly hectoring me to update it with more photos, which I do. I also gave my girlfriend's mother an Aura frame, and I hope she hectors my girlfriend to update it with more photos. But it is a present that will bring absolute delight to a mother in your life. And they have a great deal for Mother's Day. GabFest listeners can save on this perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code GabFest at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket. So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
The situation for the hostages is very unpleasant. It does, as I'm not going to give anything away too much. I mean, it resolved mostly peacefully, but it was very unpleasant for the hostages.
Like I said, the district building was the most violent meeting. I mean, there were shots fired and people died immediately, but it was no less terrifying in the B'nai B'rith. Within an hour, they had captured over 100 people. And the way they were captured was just overwhelming force and violence. And there were shots fired at the B'nai B'rith as well, though nobody died at that location. There were people bleeding from wounds. The hostages there were piled up on different floors at first on top of each other. So there were just mounds of bodies for hours, for the first couple of hours, that were just stacked. People were just thrown on top of each other in piles. And so it was, you know, some of these people, just keep in mind, had escaped the Holocaust in Europe. I mean, they had experienced that. And now they were in Washington, D.C., in the heart of Washington, D.C., with bodies piled on each other, their blood mixing with the urine and sweat. It was just horrific. I spoke to several hostages, and I actually spoke to several hostages who couldn't bring themselves, even after close to 54, more than 40 years later, to talk about these events. They just couldn't. The event, the takeover of the B'nai B'rith was terrible. Eventually, all the hostages were moved to one location on the eighth floor, and that is where the Hanafis and the hostages stayed for the remainder of the crisis over the next 2 days. The Islamic Center, the second location that was taken over, was perhaps the least violent. It was the least violent, but over there, the Hanafis also had serious grievances with one of the hostages, who was the director of the Islamic Center, who the Hanafis believed had betrayed him and had sided with the Nation of Islam. He was an Egyptian imam named Muhammad Abdur Rauf. But he was equally threatened, constantly berated, threatened that they would behead him, set him on fire. They had a can of gas sitting at his feet the whole time. All three locations were different, but there was terror in all three places.
One thing I couldn't decide after reading your book was, is this America's introduction, big introduction to Islam and to the idea of terror coming from Islam? Or does that really not start until the Islamic Revolution in Iran a couple of years later, when American hostages are held overseas, and this episode becomes sort of forgotten?
I think you're absolutely right. This is something I thought about too while writing this, is that, was this the moment? And in retrospect, and having looked at this case in retrospect, I don't think that Americans actually made full sense of this at the moment. And it's through the lens of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, which comes only 2 years later. The Hanafis are appealing their case at that time in the federal courts, but when the Iranian Revolution happens. But that really is the moment, I think, where American consciousness is invaded by this idea of an Islamic threat, an Islamic militancy. The entire pretext of the attack on Washington in 1977 was a religious pretext, though. It was a movie about Muhammad, and that whole question of the taboo around imagery of Muhammad and portrayals of Muhammad in pop culture. So the pretext of this attack was very much a religious pretext. But I think Americans at that time perhaps did not have all the vocabulary and the understanding in general of what Islam was, but also what the power dynamics in the Middle East and in the Muslim world were, and also didn't even fully appreciate America's increasingly deep involvement in the Middle East. And that's a big part of my book, is I'm also tracking American foreign policy in the Middle East and how that dynamic is shaping Khalis's life, but also his thinking and his goal to reach the perch of Islamic America as caliph.
And I think it's also probably, I'm going to use the word confusing because I can't think of a better word, confusing for Americans, because Islam is a rich religion which people associate with the Middle East and primarily with Arabs, I suppose, but with the Middle East. And almost everyone you're writing about in this book is a Black American. Is that right?
There are a lot of Black American characters, Muslim, African-American Muslim characters. Black Muslims is what the Nation of Islam called them. So I'm trying to differentiate that, just like generally African-American Muslims in the country. But there are the key players who are also immigrant Muslims, like one of the hostages, Muhammad Abdur Rauf. Khalis's teacher was an immigrant. Master Farad Muhammad, who was the founder of the Nation of Islam himself, which was the Black nationalist group that was the first big Islamic group in America. He himself is believed to be an immigrant. And I try to trace out his background in the book as well a little bit. So you're right. It is, I mean, what I think one of the takeaways from my book is that it it's hard to extricate the Black Islamic tradition in America from the immigrant Islamic tradition in America, and that these two things are really tied deeply together. Of course, the story of Islam in America begins on the slave ships. That is undoubted. But how it's revived and the ways in which it develops in the 20th century especially is a story of both Black Islam but also immigrant Islam. And that there's tension between those two as well. That's something that's part of the story.
Can you just briefly touch on Kareem Abdul-Jabbar? Because, I mean, neither your title nor your subtitle references the fact that Muhammad Ali and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, arguably the two most famous athletes in America at the time, are intimately involved in all of this, and Jabbar especially.
Intimately involved and also on the opposite sides of this. That's what's so amazing. So while Elijah Muhammad has secured the support of Muhammad Ali, and he's his star disciple, Khalis, at a similar time, manages to attract Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Louis Alcindor at the time. He was still at UCLA. By far the most exciting prospect for professional basketball. And Khalis reaches out to him. Actually, Khalis and Kareem's father had been in the same jazz circles in Harlem. So they knew each other from the jazz days. And Khalis reaches out to him because he learns about Kareem's general interest in Islam, which was just budding at that time. And Kareem is completely taken by Khalis when he meets him and really throws himself in to the Hanafi movement, into Khalis's mission, because compared to some other groups like the Nation of Islam, but also some of the more militant Black groups that Kareem knows about, Khalis strikes Kareem as a much more reasonable guy. He's talking about equality of races, but he's also has, you know, this thread of patriotism and how Blacks belong in America. So Khalis is preaching this message of patriotism along with love for all races. And so he sounds quite reasonable to Kareem, and he really throws himself in it. When Kareem becomes a pro basketball player, though, and the money starts coming in, he signs a massive contract with the Milwaukee Bucks. He starts bankrolling the Hanafi movement pretty much single-handedly. And that is what allows the Hanafis to move to Washington, D.C., to that really gorgeous headquarters on 16th Street. It wouldn't have happened without Kareem. Kareem purchased that building for the Hanafis in the early 1970s.
Are any of the hostage takers alive today? And did they talk to you for the book?
I worked on this book 7 years. And it couldn't have been any later. There are a lot of people around, not just hostages, but hostage takers too, and negotiators, and some of the ambassadors who helped with the resolution and all that. So the hostage takers. So there were 12 hostage takers. A lot of them have died since, including Khalis. But I was actually able to speak to most of the hostage takers who are alive still. Some of them are still associated with the Hanafi group of whatever remains of it. Some of them are really look back at that period in their lives. And though I don't think anybody used the word cult, but they describe their experiences in that group and in that organization and under Khalis as, they look back at those events and have no explanation for the ways they were behaving at that time and what they believed. And their understanding of Islam has evolved since. They've gone actually down many several traditions of Islam. Khalis's immediate family, though, the children who survive are still very much practice Islam in that tradition. The Khalis's immediate relatives, blood relatives, none of them actually cooperated with me for this book project, but I did speak to many Hanafis, including the hostage takers, and actually one of Khalis's wives as well. He had multiple wives. They're across the spectrum, their experiences.
Last question. I'm a native Washingtonian. I grew up here, as I said. As a 7-year-old, this experience made a mark on me. I remembered it. It was important to me. And yet, honestly, if you think about the kind of broader history of Washington, if you asked 100 Washingtonians about it, they would not know about this event. It isn't marked in the city the way 9/11 is marked in the city. It's not deeply important to the historical life of Washington. Why do you think, or maybe you disagree with that, but it feels to me like this book is a revelation because people don't know about it. Why don't we know about it?
That's a question that I've had some version of this conversation just countless times with the people that I interviewed for the book. A lot of them wondered. A lot of the people who are deeply involved with this in any way wondered the same thing: is how did this get forgotten? And that's something, honestly, that's something that's hovered over this project. I don't answer it in my book. It wasn't the project to answer that. But I think what we were talking about a little earlier, that America honestly didn't know what to make of this. This was a huge news event when it happened. It was all of the evening network news, all front pages across the country were covering this crisis when it happened. So it wasn't like this event wasn't covered in the news. It was big news. It was international news. But to make sense of it was another thing in retrospect, and almost 50 years have passed since the hostage taking, and this is the first time. My book is the first time that anybody has dove into the record and tried to recreate the events of that time. So it was forgotten, and you're right. If anything like this were to happen in America today, we would not. There's no way we'd forget about it. In 50 years, that's like saying that January 6th is just going to get forgotten in 40 years, which is not, though they are different events. But it didn't register. And I think part of it was that Americans didn't have the vocabulary to describe it. I think it was also it was sandwiched between two other major events that are really the remain present in American memory, which is the Munich massacre in Munich. I think that was the one where the Palestinian militants took the Israeli athletes hostage and killed, murdered many, and the Iranian Revolution of 1979. And in some ways, I think this event in 1977, it bridges our understanding of those two major hostage takings that most people remember. I think the 1977 siege of Washington is what really can allow us to understand how those two moments were connected.
Shahan Mufti, thanks for joining me on Gabfest Reads. Shahan's book, American Caliph, is really one of the best books I've read in years. You should get it. You should read it. It is gripping. It's so interesting. I learned so much from it, and it's just a fantastic read. So listen to it.
Thank you, David. It's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much for the kind words.
That's it for this month's edition of Gabfest Reads. Our producer is Shayna Roth. Ben Richmond is Senior Director of Operations for Slate's podcasts. Alicia Montgomery is Vice President of Audio at Slate. We'll be back next month with another edition of Gabfest Reads. Until then, me and John and Emily will be back in your feed on Thursday with a new episode of the Slate Political Gabfest.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, Young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.